know if that's going to work. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm alcoholic. My name is Tatiana. Hello. I have a sobriety date. It's October 24th, 2014. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. My sponsor knows that she's my sponsor. I meet with her regularly. I sponsor other women in this program. I do my best to practice the principles in all my affairs. And one day at a time, and by the grace of God, I have not had a drink in 5 years. I was raised in Santa Cruz, California. My parents were addicts. They were about like 17 when they had me, and just starting to dabble into meth. And so that was kind of just a little brief snippet about what that was like for a new human. Anyways, so at some point, we were taken, my brother and I were taken by CPS and put in the care of my grandmother. And they had, you know, we were in therapy, and I was told from a very young age that I have this thing called addiction, and it's going to kill me one day, and all, you know, all yada, yada, yada. I share that because my parents, they had visitation rights if they were working some sort of program. So if they were in a rehab, or if they were going to meetings, or, you know, whatever it is that they were doing, if they were doing that, they could see us. So I was one of the little kids that were in meetings. I would go to some meetings with my parents, and I remember the Serenity Prayer, and I remember the saying, to drink is to die. And I believed that quite literally. I literally thought that if I took a drink or a drug, that I would just drop dead. What else I took away from that was my parents to this day, neither one of them are sober, never got sober, never stayed sober. And so I didn't think that this thing worked. And I thought it was just a crock of garbage. And, you know, it was just, and I had this big resentment with it because I really wanted them to win us back. And that didn't happen. So that was my exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. And flash forward a little bit, I met a boy. And I was probably 12, or I was 12. And he had parents that had addiction problems as well. He never got taken by CPS, so he was like grew up in it. And he was drinking, and he was doing drugs, and he wasn't dead. And I was fascinated with that idea, because I thought that, like, if that happened, I would just die. And he has the same thing, the same parents with the same thing, and he's not dead. So that's immediately where I went with that. And I remember getting a resentment with my grandmother. I was visiting my grandmother, and I remember stealing a six-pack of some wine cooler, and I was really scared because I didn't know if I was going to die. I didn't know what was going to happen to me if I drank it, and, like, going back and forth, am I going to do it? Am I not going to do it? And then I figured, well, what greater revenge to her to watch me die? If that's what happens, then I will still feel that pain. And that's what gave me the courage to go forth and take my first drink. And I don't even think I got drunk. I think I just got, like, really sick, because it's nothing but sugar and, like, half a thought of alcohol. But, like, and then I graduated to binge drinking, like, the next time. So at this point, you're 12 or whatever, and I drank whatever I got my hands on, and I drank alcoholically, and I didn't know that was alcoholically. Like, there's a bottle, you drink, the bottle's gone, or you pass out, and that's that. I didn't know blacking out wasn't normal. I didn't know, like, drinking so much you get sick wasn't normal. And that's what I did. And so when I was drinking, it was like 12 or 13, and God, I felt alive, you know? Like, I felt like I had this courage, like none other. I was like, on top of everything, you know. And then I had this sense of superiority, because the people I was staying with when I was visiting, and where this boy was and everything like that, they would say, like, oh, we're going to go to the store and we're going to get milk, but they'd be gone for 3 days and we'd be at the house with the kids, you know, that kind of thing. So I was like, you can't tell us nothing. And, like, I just felt, like, unstoppable. And so I would go up there to go see him on, like, winter break, spring break, and this was, I don't know, like, the beginning of the high school or something like that. And that's what my binging was like. And I would drink the entire break, and that's just that. I moved we went back to Santa Cruz, and I started to have like little doses of unmanageability. And so at this point, I think when it got really bad, it was like senior year. And at this point, because I always get violently, violently ill when I was drinking, because you just drink a bottle, you get sick. So for a while, I was like, I can't do this. I'm not a drinker. I don't like this, blah, 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 blah. But then my senior year, we broke up. And that is, of course, the worst thing you can ever feel. And I'm never going to survive this breakup, right, when you're like 16. And I went on this bender, and it lasted an entire semester. And like, I was drunk the entire semester, the second half of senior year. And that was not my intention. That's just kind of like what happened. And I remember very little from that bender. And I lost a bunch of weight. I remember being called out. Like, I barely went to class. I went to class this one day, and she's just like, I walked through the door late, and she was like, every time I see you, you're like losing weight. She like stopped class to say that in front of everybody. And I was like mortified and like turned around and left, and never went back to school. And my GPA went from like a 3.8 to like a 1. I almost didn't make it into the university I was accepted into because of that. And I figured, okay, of course, at this point, none of it has anything to do with my drinking, mind you. Christopher's the problem. Santa Cruz is the problem. I just need to leave and become somebody else. And so that's what I did. I signed up for a bunch of, you know, student debt, and I'm owned and operated by Wells Fargo, but that's okay. And I went to school in San Rafael, and I was gonna become somebody else, you know. And I didn't drink or do any drugs while I moved up there for a little bit. I got a job and started working, but then I made friends. And we went out, and I'm in this social situation, right? And I need my social lubricant. And so I started drinking again, and I picked up right where I left off, except I'm managing it this time. I'm not going to drink throughout the whole semester, just on the weekends. And that's what I did. And then my definition of weekend started to change. And then it got to be like more and more frequent. And then I was starting to do things for alcohol. I went to San Diego, and for, you know, I was hanging out on the base and carrying on and doing all that. But I was there, and the guys would get off of work, and they would come, and they would like play pool, and they would have these rocks glasses with brandy in it, and it was like super, you know, sexy, and like, I don't know, it looked good. And I was like, oh my God, we can drink when we get off of work. This is genius. So I started doing that. And it was like, I had a long day. Mind you, I'm a barista, right? Like, it's like, I had a long day. I'm dealing with people. Like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to have a drink. But I can't buy it yet. So I'm going to like give people rides, because I had a car at the time. And I'm going to give people rides so that you buy me alcohol. Birthday, Christmas presents, people would buy me alcohol. I didn't ask for it. That was just like, Tati's a drinker, you know, and that's what they would do. And then by the time I was 19, I had a full liquor bar, and I was drinking daily in the evenings. And that was just to kind of chill out, relax, and usually to fall asleep. And then I quickly realized that vodka is the problem, and that I fight when I drink vodka. So I decided to switch to whiskey because it tastes better anyways. And so I have a couple of different kinds of whiskeys, just depending on like, you know, what my mood needed to be. And then whiskey kind of became a problem, but I didn't want to let it go. So during the week, I'm just going to drink wine, and it's going to be those big ass bottles of Barefoot. And it's going to be a bottle a day, and like all of this management stuff. Right. And then I started waking up shaking and vomiting. And I didn't know that had anything to do with my drinking. I diagnosed myself with an anxiety disorder. And so I went back to therapy. And my therapist was saying things like, you know, I was in nursing school, and she's like, you're in this program, and people are like dropping out of this program sober. Imagine what you are capable of doing if you weren't drinking. And I was like, oh my God, I'm passing my classes drunk. I got this, you know, that's what I took away from that. And then I'd wake up and I didn't know that I was starting to withdraw from alcohol. I didn't know any of that was going on while I was in nursing school. And, we're taught that, right? And then like we went through this addiction class in my psych department and, I was like, all of this is wrong, blah, blah, blah. I was raised by addicts, I know. But flash forward, I am starting to get really sick in the mornings. And the best way to not have these hangovers, because I can't work at like 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning, and you know, still being drunk from the last night. And I'd go to work and my hangover would like hit halfway through my shift and then I would be like KO'd on the bathroom floor. I have no idea why I didn't lose that job. I just didn't, but that was the kind of work ethic that I had at the time. And so the cure for that is to drink a little bit before you go to work, and then that way you don't get hungover. And so then I started drinking around the clock to like I don't like my hangover, so I'm not going to get them anymore. And flash forward a little bit, I did graduate. Like I went to class, I went to work, I did everything with alcohol, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And then I was like, well, I can be a functioning alcoholic, I just can't function without it. And it became a part of me. And what ended up happening, I did graduate. I was, you know, drunk when I did everything. I did a lot. I had a lot of really sketch situations and a lot of unmanageable situations. And I was 22. I had graduated. I had my license. I didn't have a job that I wanted. I never filled out a job application for my career. I couldn't figure out that you had to do that to get a job. And I was in this town that I hated, and then it got really dangerous with my boyfriend yet again, and then I was kicked out of the house, and I went to the party house, decided I was going to live there, I was kicked out of there, and I woke up in the morning, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw exactly what I had become. I was 20 pounds lighter than I am now, which you can't tell, but I'm not a, you know, very big person. So I was like super, super, super underweight, very pale. At some point I decided to pull out most of my eyebrow, and I was like, and I looked in the mirror, and the things that I was willing and was doing to people, and the thoughts that I was having about myself was really scary. And it was like the first time I saw the person that I was, and I was like, oh my God, I'm just like my mom. And so I go to work, and I'm panicking, and hammered, absolutely hammered. And I was too drunk to work, and my boss, pulled me to the back so I can eat and sober up, and she worked my shift for me while I was detoxing and like trying to like, you know, process and get enough to where I can stand straight and like shake people's hands. And she told me that my stories went from like, you know, the fun party stories like, oh, Tati did what, ha 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 ha, into something really dangerous. And she said she was scared for my life and that I needed to get sober. And I was like, you're right, blah blah blah. And then it took, I don't know, maybe an hour before I'm talking myself out of that, right? And but I was still like in this mess. Like I still didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have, you know, this guy that I hated anyways. And like all of this, I didn't have all these things and my life is over and blah, 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 blah. So I got a text from a friend of mine who's also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was just saying, hey, and he's like, hey, what's going on? And I was like, this is the worst day ever. And he's like, okay. So he shows up on my lunch break and he listens to my rant about a bunch of garbage and all the stuff that was going on. And then I was like, at the end of it, it's like, my boss says I need to get sober, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, so what's that about getting sober? And I was like, yeah, my boss says I need to get sober, you know? And at this point I'm just like, okay, it's not that serious. I just need to, I need to figure something else out, you know? And at this point, like, I am the queen of rationalization and manipulation and, like, figuring out all my little plans and designs and everything. And at this point, I don't have any more plans or designs. At this point, all of my decisions, all of them, including whether or not I'm going to eat today, was surrounding alcohol. And and I didn't want to live anymore. I was 22 years old and I wanted to go back to Santa Cruz. I was going to clock out, drive back to Santa Cruz, take all of the drugs that I was too afraid to take until my body stopped and I didn't wake up anymore. And that's how I was going to commit suicide. And it's like a choosing overdose. But like, and then so mind you, that's where I was at. And I still didn't believe it was bad enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that was when I was 22. I knew that I needed AA when I was 19. I knew I was an alcoholic when I was 19. And it was when I start drinking and driving, check. When I this, when I that, you know, all of these conditions about what I decide an alcoholic needs to look like, right? And I kept hitting those and kept changing what needed to happen before I came to AA. And so he said that, and he was just like, well, if you want to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, he looked me in the face and he said that working the 12 steps was the best decision he had ever made. And I believed him. And he gave me the phone number of this girl, and she took me to some like meeting that might as well have been at dawn. It was at noon, in Larkspur. And like, so I go to this meeting and there's a bunch of people there. And at this point, I had this huge resentment against organized religion, and I don't like men telling me what to do, and like how to live my life. I know you looked. we share the pants. and I don't like that. And so I get there and there's like this middle-aged man that's standing up at the podium, and it's like, okay, let's hear what you have to tell me. And I remember we were going around and they were like, is anybody in the first 30 days? And you had to stand up. It wasn't raising your hand. They wanted you to stand up and introduce yourself. So I stood up, and now I had said like, oh, hey, I'm Tatsy. I'm the alcoholic, you know, and then people kind of get off your back about how much you drink. But I've done that before. But when I stood up in the meeting and I said that, it was weird. It was really weird, you know, and I commend the newcomers who can raise their hand and do that, because it was a trip. It was like a whole new feeling for me. And then I sat down and the girl that brought me was like, good job. And I'm like, why? And I was like, whatever. So this dude gets up and he's going to share, and I'm just like, all right, let's hear it. And the first thing out of his mouth was, I really don't want to F and be here, except he cursed. And I was like, ah, he dropped an F-bomb in the microphone, you know? And like at that point, it shattered whatever I thought I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to another meeting just because he swore in the microphone. I don't know anything else that was said that day. That is the only reason why I went to another meeting. I met this guy who was like, it's always a good day in the neighborhood, and like really annoying. And there's a bunch of people that were like in my face and like introducing themselves. How are you? And it's like, I just quit drinking, so it really sucks, you know? And here's a big book. And it was this big book, and they handed it to me, and I stuffed it in my purse and went about my day. So the girl that took me to this meeting was talking to me about sponsorship, and you should get a sponsor and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, you took me to a meeting. And she's like, well, you need to ask. And I was just like, will you sponsor me? And she's like, yes, we're going to meet once a week, and we're going to read through the book, and we'll work a step out of the book. Okay. So I'm doing this thing, and at this point, I was detoxing, and I didn't, you know, have money or insurance, or and I didn't like seize in front of somebody, so nobody like called 911 and sent me to a hospital or anything like that. But I was really sick for a couple of days. I shook, I couldn't sleep, and for like 2 weeks I didn't sleep, and the anxiety was like crazy. I'd be like cooking and like would just run out the door. Like I would just hear it, you know, like go get out now and just take off in the middle of the night. And there were women who would like take me to these really like, they'd want to pick me up and like get coffee, and I couldn't talk really to people at this point. And so I was like really a weird and awkward girl. And they still wanted to hang out with me, and they told me that they had similar experiences, and they told me some of their stories about when they were detoxing and things that they did when they were new in recovery. Somebody told me about candy, and I was like, yes. And so I got these Jolly Rancher hard candies, and I carried that everywhere. And even like if I get like super like antsy and thirsty, which thank God it hasn't been in quite some time now, but I'll still go and get Jolly Rancher candies just to like bring it all the way back, you know, start way back from basics. That stuff worked. And so I learned things like that, and they let me be weird and they let me be awkward. But most importantly, they continue to take me to meetings. And what these women did is they showed me, that it was possible to have a life without alcohol. And that was my biggest hang up, was that I'm a drinker. Like, and at this point, I always thought that I drank because of my parents and poor me and all this trauma, and I have PTSD and anxiety, which might be true to some extent. But at the end of my drinking, you guys, I have no idea why I drank. I don't know. I just drank, you know, and that's it. And it wasn't at the end of it. It was not because of my parents. They had nothing to do with it. They lived 100 miles away, and I hadn't seen them in years. And so it's a part of me. I need it, you know, and these women were showing me it's possible to have a life without it. And then it got to a point where I really wanted to be okay. And I didn't want to have to keep fighting these ideas of suicide. And I didn't want to have to like feel the way that I was feeling anymore. And I didn't believe that this program was going to work for me. And that was a really scary place to be, to like know, like it felt like it was being haunted almost. And there was a point where I thought there was like this demon inside of me with these horrible thoughts, horrible, horrible thoughts in my head. And the women listened to me and nobody was surprised. Like, I've never said anything to anybody and they're like, oh, you know, just completely like blown away. Nobody was surprised. They were just like, yeah, man, this happened to me and this is what it looked like and this is what I did. And so doing that, I got to learn how to borrow hope. And I borrowed your guys' hope until I could find my own. And then I remember I was somewhere around the third step, and I have like, there's large portions of my life that I don't remember. And my memories like start from when I came into AA or was making the decision to come into AA. And even that is hazy. So my first couple steps, I'd like hardly remember. I just remember it was really weird. She wanted to sit and read this book, and it was written by some dead guy, and like there's like, you know, it didn't make any sense to me, and it's like really old. So we're reading, and it got to the doctor's opinion, and it got to Bill's story. And what was really weird is I really related to this dead guy who was like a stockbroker. I can't tell you jack about stocks at all. And he had a totally different like experience with life than I did, right? I was never like a veteran or anything like that. But he talked about how I was feeling, and my life looked very similar to his, and the decisions that I had made were very similar to his. Bill and I shared a lot of the same thoughts, and this was written in the 30s, and I've never met him. And that was something that was really powerful for me. You know, like he would say, like, would drink at school or whatever. Check, I did that. You know, he would this, he would that. He had these, like, he would take these risks that no normal people would. And, like, it would always work out until it didn't. And then it got, like, really, really, really bad and really unmanageable. I felt that way. But the biggest one was that he decided to join that endless procession of sots before him. That's where I was when I came in, was just like, I knew that I was going to drink myself to death. And I was okay with that because I can't stop and I'm not willing to stop. And, so I really related to that in his story. And then I got to be, I'm jumbling around a little bit, but like I got to be somewhere around the third step, and, we held hands and we prayed, and there was not some miraculous discovery when I did that with my first sponsor. But what happened was, I was in the yard in a town that I hated at somebody else's house, because I didn't have my own house. Trying really hard. I tried so hard to be a smoker. I really did. And I'm like sucking down this cigarette and still had the same job that I hated. You know, nothing in my outside life had changed, but it was the first time I started to believe that I might be okay. You know, and then there was the fourth step, and I got to the fourth step, and I was absolutely terrified for no reason, because I had no idea what a four step was. But everybody else was scared, so I'm going to be scared, and I'm going to make a really big deal out of it, you know? And I was definitely the girl that came in, and like, I had no intention of staying sober. I had no intention in staying in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to find my own place to live and just, bye, thanks for the help. What happened is, when I had borrowed that hope and I started to feel okay, I made a decision to try the program. And I told my sponsor at one point, I was like, hey, like, I don't really, you know, lifetime of sobriety, you know? And she was just like, just try it for a year. And if you don't like it, go get drunk. And I was just like, okay, not doing a year. And, but I got 30 days and it blew my mind. I went a month. In the last few years of my drinking, I'm drunk around the clock for years. And I hadn't had days of sobriety, and that does not need to be your experience to be an alcoholic. That's just mine. But I got a month and I was like, there's something really powerful here, right? And so I made this decision to do this. And so I'm like whining about this fourth step I don't know anything about. And I finally do it and I'm writing all this stuff down. And I'm, feeling some sort of way about it. And I have it all together and I'm gonna go, like, bring it to her. And I lost it. And I knew that I left it at some meeting somewhere, and everybody was reading it, and I was like panicking, and I had half of AA out looking for my fourth step, and it was under my dresser, and nobody was reading it. And then I finally go, and I do my fifth step, and she's like, "Okay, well, I gotta go, so I'll see you next week." Blah blah blah, and I was like, "That's it." Like all of that panicking and like fear for like what, And then the first time through the steps was very much like a checklist. So I breezed through 6 and 7. I made a list. And then it was time for amends, and I made some amends. And one thing, like my brother and my grandmother lived in Santa Cruz, 100 miles away, and I went down there to go make amends. And I was like, I'm in AA, blah blah blah. And he's like, "Thank God." I was like, "What do you mean, thank God? You had no idea about my drinking. You live here." I didn't hide it from them. Not even talking to them, hardly. Just by looking at me, they could see how much I was deteriorating that rapid. And that was new for me. And then the 10th step and the 11th step, and we were talking about like my behaviors and like not like I can't make amends and then continue to behave the way that I need to make amends for. And so then it goes into this meditation, and there's like nothing in here that like tells you exactly how to meditate. So I decided that like, oh, well, meditation is like Oming and Buddha and all these things, and I know nothing about Buddhism whatsoever. And it didn't work for me, so I found something that did. And my first form of meditation was like cooking. And then it was walking the dogs, and very slowly, and doing all of the step work the first time, was, I couldn't do Jack without alcohol. And then I learned to go to work and go home, and I learned to go to work on time and go home and then walk the dogs. And I learned to go to work on time, be good at work, and go home and walk the dogs and go grocery shopping, right? And I learned how to do all these things slowly and slowly, slowly and surely. And then she's like, "Okay, surprise, go sponsor people." And I'm like, "No, I'm not ready for that," And I got my first sponsee, and I remember I called her and I was like crying, and I was like, "I don't remember what we did for the first time. I don't remember that time at all." And she like sponsored my first couple sponsees. For me, through me, and that was really cool to have that. And what happened is I developed this fellowship around me, and it, there were people that were calling me that had gotten sober around the same time I did. There were newcomers that were calling me even before I was like sponsoring people. And she's like, "I don't know why you're so scared. You're talking to newcomers anyways, and like all of these things." And I was happy. I was so happy for the first time, and I can't remember, and it had nothing to do with alcohol. I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't getting high either. Like all, and I didn't have like, all the things that I thought that I needed to be happy, and it was really cool. So it was about a year sober that we moved out here. My father-in-law got really sick, and so we decided to come out here and take care of him. So he became priority. I stopped going to meetings. My sponsor lives an hour away. I lost my sponsees and or stopped sponsoring people. And I got really crazy really fast. Really, really crazy. Really, really fast. And I didn't pick up a drink, but I got to be, and it wasn't even suicidal, but I was thinking a lot. Almost every day I got behind the wheel of a car driving off the road. And it wasn't to kill myself at this point, it was just to get all of the noise to stop. I just can't with the noise in my head. And so I started looking around for a sponsor that was closer around here. I started raising my hand as new to town. I started introducing myself to people. I started doing all the things that I used to do when I was brand new in recovery, and I started to build that fellowship up around me, and that happened pretty quickly. I started to the noise stopped very quickly as soon as I decided to come back to the program. And I got a new sponsor, and I started working the steps again, and I started working them from a different perspective. Or at this point, like the first time I went through the steps was exactly what I needed at the time. And then I got to work them again with a different perspective for what I needed at that time. And this, my current sponsor, she had me write out a first step and what that meant, and this idea of being powerless over alcohol, right? And like, I really didn't like the idea of walking around with chains and being dragged around by a bottle of Jameson, because that never happened. But I would, like, all of my decisions were surrounding alcohol. I couldn't, like, get anywhere on time. I couldn't, I was mortified all of the time. Like, there's so many different examples of me being powerless. And there's something, which, before I butcher it, I'm just going to do this because they say it a lot better than I can. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month or a day or hours ago. We are without defense against the first drink. There is nothing that has ever been able to get in between me and the action of picking up a drink. No boyfriend, no therapist, no drug dealer, no bartender, myself, has never been able to physically stop me from taking a drink when the thought crosses my mind. I am without defense against alcohol. The most almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove, and I resonated with that. And that was me to a T, again, written in this book by some dead guy that is like describing my actions, right, and predicting what's going to happen. And that was me. Like, I could promise myself I'd wake up violently ill and be just like, oh, I'm not doing that again. And I'd be drunk in an hour, you know, because I didn't want to feel that way anymore. And, like, would totally forget everything that happened. And when you consider what happens to me when I take a drink, it's crazy. My roommates would be just like, are you sure you want some wine? You know, and it's like, yeah, I'm grown. I can have some wine. Mind you, I'm not 21 at that point, right? But what that idea of what happens to me, I lose all control. Like, I cannot guarantee what I'm going to say, do, go, anything, how much I'm going to take once I take one. I cannot guarantee. All bets are off every single time. And she had me write that out, and then we talked about unmanageability, and I was like, was it really that unmanageable? I still had a job, my car, blah, blah, blah. I was living in my car. And I couldn't go to Santa Cruz County. I couldn't go to Calaveras County. I had decided that I'm a little enough fish that, I don't need to pay my student loans or the IRS, and that backfired tremendously. I don't recommend that. Mm-hmm. But like, all of this was different. Like, I had credit card debt from my like 21st birthday or something like that, that I had just paid off like a year and a half ago or 2 years ago. Just, like, at that point, like, in like all of these. And she's like, you don't think that's even a little bit unmanageable? And I'm like, oh. And then there was the second step. Coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I don't like the idea that I'm like crazy and insane, right? But again, like, if you think about what happens to me, the consequences of my drinking, it's no normal person would pick up a drink again, but I don't have that ability. And what I've learned is that whatever happens here in this room, in the recovery, was a lot more powerful than me. And then there's this idea of being sane, which I'm not going to read it, don't worry, but it talks about, we just read a vision for you with a sponsee this morning, and it talked about when Bill was in the hotel lobby and he had a choice between going to the bar or picking up the phone, right? And thinking about helping somebody else brought him back to sanity. And this idea of sanity wasn't that like, oh, I'm now like, you know, even keel. It was like, oh, I cannot take a drink. That's about as sane as it gets, you know? And I could swallow that. And then we got to the third step. And again, the third step for me was a lot of making a decision to continue or try recovery first before my own ideas. And there's lots of people who have lots of different ideas. And that was, you know, it's really nitty gritty, cut and dry. And that's the kind of recovery that I need. And then I did a fourth step again. And it was not the 150 people that were on my first four step, but there was a lot more. There was still plenty of people on there, and I was just like, oh, wow, like, I get to look at that, you know? And then I go and I do my fifth step, and I do this with her, and at this point, I thought that, like, that it wouldn't be a big deal, because I remember the first time doing my fist up, and I was like, that's it, and that's not how I felt after I did my second fist up. I felt pretty crummy, and I felt really embarrassed because I had a year and some change of sobriety, and I had a lot of work to do. And that's when I realized, I was like, oh, like this is some like an ongoing process. Like I am not perfect, and that was really humbling, and it did not feel good. But I was able to look my sponsor in the face and tell her that, and she nodded her head like she knew what I was talking about, and she's like, it's all right, we can do something about this. I can work with honesty, and real quick, I'll read the fist that promises. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist in character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we've taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Now, the way this is written is a lot like, oh, you're gonna feel wonderful and like skipping down the lane, but for me, I did learn to pick my head up, and I did learn to look people in the eye, and like I had for the first time been really honest with myself and with our Creator. And when there's something about looking somebody in the face, and I chose somebody who knew that this was a life and death errand, which I would, roll my eyes when I was new and be like, God, you guys are so dramatic. But legit, like, I don't know what's gonna happen if I take a drink. This may be the time I do actually take my life. This may be the time I crash my car into yours and kill your kids in the back seat. Like, I have no idea because I cannot control what happens once I take a drink. And she understood that. And she's a third party, and she didn't judge me, and she wasn't involved in any of the mess. And she got to share her experience about what we can do moving forward. And she gave me that hope and reminded me we are doing this to grow, and we're going to grow because there is a way out today. I started to have this spiritual experience, and what she did during my fifth step is she started to play like the devil's advocate and would like bring up their side of the street, and not their side of the street, but like their perspective. Like, you don't think that hurt their feelings? I was like, to hell with their feelings, like, and all of this stuff. And I didn't like that because she was like, well, didn't this, didn't that, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, why are we talking about them like that? Like, I don't need to feel any worse than I already do, But this idea of having a spiritual experience is all about a change in my perspective. A change in my reaction to life sufficient to bring about recovery. And that's what she was starting to do. And I needed to see that example before I was able to have that connection myself. And I started to feel that. And like, I didn't feel good about myself, and I felt really embarrassed and ashamed. But I knew that it wasn't gonna last, and I was ready to move forward, which meant that I get to look at these character defects. And it meant that I get to work on these character defects. And I didn't see all of that happening for me right away. A lot of the growth that has happened was a lot of hindsight, looking at it, being like, oh, that was different. Like, for example, last week at work, I struggle a lot at work. There's this girl, one of my coworkers got into my face, and I have a thing with my face, like, just don't get into swinging distance. And I didn't hit her. I didn't hit her. I didn't lose my job. I said some choice words, and I get to look at that, but I did not hit her, and that is a change in my reaction to that situation. And that's something that I learned how to do here. And then I got to make this list again, and there were people on this list and my first list that I was not willing to make amends to at all. And I got to be honest about that. And she walked me through that, and she was like, okay, well, these are some things that we can do in that situation. And it got to a point where there is, I can honestly say that there's nobody that I'm absolutely not willing to. There's somebody who I'm not going to call. There's also like legal stuff around that situation, and I would not be very happy if I were to see her. But if I were to run into her in a store, I would make that amends without a hesitation. And that was not the case even a year ago. And she got to walk me through that and how to grow through those situations. There was somebody who, the last time I saw him, there were death threats, and I was like, this is legitimately like not safe to make this amends. Like, I can't do this, blah, 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 blah. And this time around, I reached out to him, and I was prepared to make that amends. And he was like, you don't owe me amends. I never had to see him. great, you know. And then there was other people that I really wasn't super juiced on seeing, and I went down there anyways. And I got to talk to her for about an hour about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to share that message with her, and I was not expecting that whatsoever. And then there was somebody else that I really, 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 really owe an amends to. And we had an appointment to meet, and I was feeling some sort of way about it, and he didn't show up. And that's okay too, because I did my part, you know. And it's not about them hearing my side. It's not about, you know, receiving forgiveness. It's not about my apology. It's not about any of that. It's about me picking up what, you know, the damage that I had done. And as long as I'm doing my part, then that's all that I can do. Then we go to this 10th step, and with the 10th step, there. When things are coming up, my sponsor talks a lot about this idea of a spot check inventory, right? And to like really look at a situation quickly in the moment and then making a different action. And I'm not going to find the page in the right time, but it talks about that in the book too. And it's very clear in what we do when those things happen. Maybe I will find it. Where is it? Here it goes. We continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately. We make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone, and then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. And when we're doing stuff like that, like again, like I learned in that fifth step, there's something about saying something out loud that really takes the power out of it, you know. And it's the I'm being honest, which means I need to be like accountable to correcting it if I'm really going to do this program. And so it takes it back into that, and it's like an in the moment thing, and that's been really cool. And I love that it says this is not an overnight matter, because I am not the epitome of perfection and I am not you know, the perfect example of how to work AA or anything like that, but I try. And I'm not drunk yet, and I'm not dead yet, you know. And then we go into the 11th step. And every day I pull out the book, and I read pages 86 to 88. And you know, anytime that it says ask, I ask. Anytime that it says pray, I pray. Anytime that there's an action in it, I do it. And then my form of meditation has changed a lot over the last couple of years. You know, I did try the like sitting quiet, and then I tried with the music, and then I get distracted. Then I did yoga. Then I did this, and then I did that, and blah, 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 blah. The point is, I still try. Even if it needs to change, and even if it grows. And then I got to the 12th step. And 12 step work has been absolutely incredible. And it's not just sponsorship, it's how I show up, and it's how I carry that message. And it's about giving back to AA what has been given to me. But I have had the honor of sponsoring women in this program. There was one, we just did her fifth step last week, and she was getting out of the car. And I usually take her home afterwards, and she like gets out of the car, and I was like, "Where are you going?" She's like, "I brought my car." I was like, "You did?" And she was like, "Yeah, I figured that you wouldn't want to, you know, get back off the freeway and take me home. You just got off of work, this, that, and the other." And I'm like, "That was really considerate of you, you know." And just like totally, and I had nothing to do with that. And this was working in her life in that way. And like I work with her, and she is the most. She has character defects like I do, and that was really cool to see that. You know, to see that light come on. And then I have other sponsees that sponsor other women, and we get to talk about that, you know, and I get to see that happen for them. I have had the honor to hear at somewhere around 10 fifth steps, and I get to share that safe space with them. And I know what it is to give a fifth step, and I know how important that is for somebody. I know how important that is to keep that quiet, you know, and I know how important it is to be honest. And I have the experience of feeling good, feeling bad, feeling neutral, feeling all sorts of ways about doing that fifth step, and I get to share that with them. And then today, this morning, I read A Vision for You, which if you haven't read it, or if you haven't read it in a while, read it, because it is amazing. There's so much good stuff that happens in here. But I'm listening to my sponsee this morning talk about, you know, a situation in her life. And that situation was the same situation, that was there when we first started working together. And she has a totally different perspective on that. And I got to see the steps working in her life. And I almost started to cry just because, like, wow. Like, I'm totally blown away by the power of this program, and feel really honored that I get to witness that, you know. And then I love how it talks about in A Vision for You, it was talking about Bill and how he's in that hotel lobby, right? And he is feeling lonely, and the one thing that he thought he needed didn't go through, right? And he's like, oh, well, I can just go get a ginger ale. Wait, I can actually get a couple of drinks, you know? Or he can go to a directory and it says, but what about his responsibilities, his family, and the men who would die because they would not know how to get well? Ah, yes, those other alcoholics, right? And then his sanity returned. His sanity meaning, wait, I cannot take a drink, you know? And that's as sane, that's as sane as it gets. And he goes and he meets with Dr. Bob, and they start Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to receive that message, however many years later, because of that one decision. You know, and that's crazy. And I have the experience in even after the second time I worked the steps out of the big book of backing away from the program, I have this big, beautiful, happy, healthy life today, and I'm busy, you know? And so like I'm really busy. So meetings, doing the work, all of those things, you know, are really easily pushed to the side, right? And what happened is I had a resentment at work, and it was really small, so I didn't think I needed to talk about it. I didn't think that I needed to bounce it off a sponsor. I didn't think I needed somebody else's perspective. I didn't think I needed to be truly honest with myself, with my higher power about that situation. I decided that. So I didn't do anything about it. And I'm really pissed off at this doctor, and then I get on Highway 80, and Highway 80 becomes my problem. And then I get home, and my husband didn't do the dishes, and I lost my mind. I lost it. And then he leaves. He's upset. I'm upset. And I went to Los Mocajetes in Vallejo. All I wanted was a burrito. And I'm sitting in there, and I'm sitting at the bar thinking about killing myself. And that was hours, within hours of that, of having that resentment and identifying that resentment and choosing not to do anything about it. It was not days. It was not weeks. For me, it was hours. And what the voice that came through was, if you do actually take a drink, you might actually kill yourself. Maybe you try the program first. And that was not, believe me, like if it's up to me, I'm drinking. You know, that was not something that, you know, came from me. That came from all the experience that I had here. But mind you, while I was there in that restaurant, the time that I had in this program, however many times I've worked the steps, the women I've sponsored, all of that, none of that meant anything. The only thing that was in that bar with me was me and a conception of a higher power. That was it. You know, and because of that, there was a defense against that thought to drink because of what I've learned here. And that's what I've been given here in this program. And I have become somebody who can keep a job, who can be a good employee. I was late to work, and just because I was, you know, being really irresponsible and for really no reason at all, so I'm just going to take my time. And my boss called me, genuinely concerned for my safety because that's so not like me. And she's like, are you okay? She called me because I was late. You know, that's the kind of person that I've become today. I've become somebody that somebody wants to marry. Newsflash, you guys, we get to choose who we want to sleep with. Okay, we get to choose. Yes, it's not just like whoever happens to be there. Like when I was under 21, the only like dating criteria I had was you were 21 and preferably had a penis. That was it. That was it, you know? And like that doesn't have to be the way today. And I am somebody that somebody wants to rent to. I'm really good to my dogs. I have friends today. I had a girlfriend of mine needed to rush her mom to the emergency room. She called me to pick up her kids. Me. You know, I went and I had the opportunity yesterday to speak at WUDI, which is the Women Under the Influence of the 12 Steps, and like had an opportunity to do that. Like all of these things are happening. People didn't call me. You know, nobody wanted to be around me. You know, none of that stuff. People didn't call me with their problems. People didn't want to sit down and read some book written by some dead guy. You know, none of those things were happening when I was out there living on life on my terms. And the things that I get to experience today are amazing. I have hobbies. I have hobbies. I eat regularly. I don't want to die. You know, all of these amazing things that I was not expecting when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at all. I came in because I didn't have any other ideas. And I mean, I can talk on and on and on about all of that. But really, if I'm being completely honest with you, working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best decision I have ever made. And I'm going to read this and then I'll be quiet. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. I'd like another hand for touching on. Let's see, there's a lot of food, way too much food in the kitchen, so feel free to take some with you, or if you know some place that can land, go ahead and feel free. There's also a little donation thing, some, I don't know where it is, but it's somewhere. But other than that, that's pretty much it. We'll close out with the Serenity Prayer.
Hey, John, just stop.
What?
Just stop.
Oh.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.